Line 8. Is there any discussion on this? I will move that this draft, LC 598, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any opposition to the motion? Then it's allowed, and LC 598 will be introduced as a committee bill. I'll now open the public hearing on House Bill 2274. The witnesses come forward, please.
Thank you. Can you step down for a second?
I want to ask Sam to just
do what now?
Ask Sam to give a brief summary.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's getting to do this.
Mm-hmm. Before we begin, we'll have counsel give a short summary of this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2274 was submitted at the request of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Law Commission. This bill revises the laws relating to garnishments to settle the statute of limitation conflicts, updates statutory definitions, and it streamlines garnishment procedures, and it clarifies the procedures for challenging garnishment and the respective duties of the parties.
Thank you. Witnesses may introduce themselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shatterly, State Representative, District 23, and also Chair of the Oregon Law Commission. I want to thank in absentia Representative Williams and staff for scheduling these Law Commission bills today. We have several before us. And as chair of the Law Commission, I thought I would just give some brief introductory remarks about the commission and then get into the bills as we proceed through the rest of the agenda today. I think several of you were at the reception last week, but for the record, just to remind you that the Law Commission was created in 1997 to undertake a continuous program of law revision and reform and improvement. And we work in partnership between the Office of Legislative Counsel and Willamette University that is good enough to provide staffing and a place to call home, but it really is a partnership between the legislature and the law school in terms of the management of the affairs of the commission. The commission itself, by statute, consists of 13 members, four of whom are designated by legislative appointment. It also includes the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the deans of the three law schools in the state, and four members appointed by the bar. And so not only does it have a partnership aspect between the legislature and Willamette University, but obviously that incorporates the judiciary, the law schools, the executive branch through the Attorney General's office, and a governor appointee. And so it's a very comprehensive and broad-based and representative group. And even broader than the 13 commissioners, we have over 200 volunteers, primarily practicing attorneys and judges with law professors as well, representing academia, serving on law commission work groups. And the bills that you have before you are the product of the last interim's work, specifically House Bill 2274, which we'll be hearing first, is the product of a work group that was chaired by Representative Williams and is something of a cleanup bill from a major rewrite of garnishment law that we did in the 2001 session. Always when you undertake such a broad reform as what we accomplished in 2001, we tend to find loose ends as the reforms are implemented. And so predominantly that is what House Bill 2274 addresses, as well as some good improvement for the sake of improvement while we're at it. But I just wanted to address you briefly at the outset of these law commission bills to thank you on behalf of the commission, to call to your mind the role the commission plays in developing law improvement legislation that, frankly, often doesn't rise to the level of sex appeal or political interests that might otherwise attract the attention of some of our more traditional groups, but it needs to be done nevertheless, and the Law Commission is a good home for that kind of law reform because while it's quiet and unobtrusive, the changes that are made through these law commission work group efforts do have an impact on the lives of Oregonians that we serve together. So with that, I will resume my seat at the committee desk, but thank you for the record for your consideration of these bills today. I'll turn it over to Dave Kanegi, who is the associate. Did I get that right again? Okay, Dean at the law school, and also we're very pleased to have him serve in a dual capacity as executive director of the Oregon Law Commission. Again, I said that's where the commission is centered, at the law school, and Dave and his able staff are the ones who coordinate the work of the task forces, and when we get into session, coordinate the workings of our law commission bills through the legislative process. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Kanegi, and thank you again.
Thank you. Your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Kanegi. I'm Associate Dean at the Willamette University College of Law and also serve as Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you, Chair Shetterly of the Oregon Law Commission, for your comments. And I simply wish to add two other little thoughts as we begin here today the presentation of the first four of a total of 14 bills that through the course of this legislative session we trust will be proceeding through the legislative process, most of which will proceed, we trust, through the Judiciary Committee itself. Again, today we bring four bills before you. The story I wish to tell has to do with my oldest son when he got to junior high school, because it illustrates something about the work of the Law Commission that I think is unique and ought to be understood as we embark on the discussions that are about to follow. It was at that point that he met a math teacher who taught him that it was not enough to get the right answer. You have to show your work. When he came home with the right answer but no credit, he was really discouraged. But he learned the lesson, as have my other kids, and as have we in the Oregon Law Commission. It's one thing to bring you a bill. It's another to bring you a bill that includes explanation and support in the form of written reports that explain what we're doing, that in effect show our work and bring to you a level of transparency about the lawmaking process that we hope was not only refreshing and informative for you as legislative decision makers, but also serves the people of the state of Oregon in the long term in understanding what it is that's been enacted. We released just last week, and by now most of you should have received or will soon receive the biennial report of the Law Commission, in which is contained the reports which accompany each of our legislative proposals, as is the case today for the four that will come before you. And the reason I want to mention the importance of those reports and of showing our work is because you'll see three of the four bills that are up today are actually bills that in effect are continuation bills from work that the Law Commission presented to the legislative session last time around. But because we show our work and we care about the content of our work itself, where fixes and further clarification is needed, we retain jurisdiction over those problems and challenge our work groups to continually improve the law of the state of Oregon, again, for the benefit of these the people of our state. And three of the four bills today, starting with the bill you'll first hear from in garnishments, has a significant component of making certain that the good work we did before is made better through continued vigilance and attention to detail. There are some additional changes in the garnishments bill that will come before you next that you'll also hear described in a moment. And rather than anticipate each of the bills in sequence, I'll leave it there, and I'd like, with the chair's permission, to introduce both David Hendricks and Randall Jordan, who will be testifying concerning HB 2274. With that, unless there are any questions, I'd like to proceed with 2274 and those two witnesses.
Questions of the witness? I'd like to thank you and thank you on your work with the commission. I know as a lawyer, over time, our code becomes more and more disjointed as amendments and variations are enacted by the Assembly, and it's refreshing occasionally to update those for the clarity purposes that you brought forth. I do have a couple questions regarding the bill. Would you like to address those, or I can have a couple more witnesses come forward?
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
If I may.
We'll have our next group come forward. And your names for the record?
Chair Ackerman, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Randall Jordan from the Department of Justice.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You want to make a presentation, or would you like to just take questions?
I can do a real brief statement. I just wanted to add one thing about the garnishment bill. As Dave Carnegie just told you, the law commission bills are kind of unique in that you actually get a report with them that gives you a lot of the thinking and which hopefully responds to some of the questions you might have before you have an opportunity to ask them. The amendments you see here are, the changes you see in 2274 are kind of a follow-up from a much bigger bill last session in which we repealed all of the garnishment statutes and rewrote them. And what I will say is, with respect to the things that are in this bill, the great majority of them don't constitute mistakes that were made in the bill. In fact, I would say there's only a couple of very minor little things that we are changing where we looked at it and said, oops. The great majority of them are things that happen every time I've worked on one of these law improvement bills, and I've worked on a few over the years, where you go through, you rewrite the law, you put it in black letter, and people read it as though they're seeing it for the first time. And then they look at it and they say, well, why is it like that? And why does it work that way? And maybe it should work differently. And what happens if you do this, et cetera? And those are all good questions to ask. And a lot of what you see in this bill are, in fact, things where people said, maybe we ought to be doing things different, or can you do this way? One of the biggest thing, the changes, substantive changes the bill makes is someone asked the question that could have been asked under the old law just as easily, can you put more than one debtor on a single garnishment form? Some people were doing that. Some attorneys were, some agencies were, some weren't. And the question was, well, what should be a good policy decision about whether you should be able to do that or not? And the answer was, well, in some cases you should. They said if you have joint debtors, and they're probably the classic example of that is where you've got a husband and wife who are jointly liable on a debt. The conclusion reached it in the amendments you see in this bill is you should be able to issue a single writ of garnishment for the joint debtors, and the classic example of that would be on a bank account where you're issuing it to a bank, that you shouldn't have to issue two writs of garnishment. And because we had banking representatives at the work group, and we worked through some of the issues that arise when the work group worked through some of the issues that arise when you do that, such as, you know, they have fees that they charge, you charge double fees, et cetera. In fact, one amendment that you have on the bill specifically relates to that issue. But the reason I mention that is just to point out that this is kind of an ongoing process that the work group has undertaken. It wouldn't be surprised me if they think of some more things to look at next session as well. I think as you look through this and if you look at the report, you'll find that most of these are looking at clarification, at consolidation of some of the provisions, trying to shorten things down a little bit. Basically, those types of changes in the law.
Thank you.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I think Dave has properly summarized what the intent was and what our goals were with the bill. And I think we're ready to answer your questions if you have any specific questions.
Okay, fine. Does the committee have any question of the witnesses on this bill? It's either well said or not understood. So, but after having gone through this a year ago with that garnishment bill I suppose about 45 pages, this is pretty mild stuff. All right. Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a question that I hear out in the campaign trail. Does the commission make efforts to reduce the number of laws in any way, or is it just clarifying existing law? Are there recommendations made by the commission to say this law no longer really has an impact?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Anderson, one of the specific charges is to look for obsolete laws and to get rid of them. In the first session after the law commission was created, they put together two of the principles they put together. One was got rid of a whole chapter of law relating to a retirement system for teachers that had been on the books forever and nobody had an interest of putting in a bill to get rid of it. But it was confusing because it was there, and people would look at it, and they would call about it, and, you know, somebody had to come forward to put a bill in to get rid of it, and they did, and it's gone. And that was good. The other thing they did that session, the second bill they did that session that Representative Prozanski will remember, was a large bill to take what had been four or five different procedures for infractions that were out there and to consolidate them into a single set of laws that now show up as Chapter 153. And to basically reduce those all that duplicative language down to one set of language that applied to all. So, yes, the answer is that is part of what they do.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dave, if memory serves, there was one other redundant statute that we, I think had been rendered obsolete by a citizen initiative that the Law Commission picked up through working with Legislative Council and repealed that as well. So, actually, the repeal of obsolete statutes, I think, is one of the express charges of the Law Commission.
Further discussion on House Bill 2274. Thank you for your presentation. Any further witnesses on this bill? I don't have any signed up. Okay, with that, I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2274 and open the public hearing on 2275.
Mr. Chair, I think I was supposed to say something about these Dash 1 amendments. I don't know if there's a procedural something that has to be done to introduce these.
Well, I can reopen the public hearing for that.
What are we doing?
Or save it for work session.
Right? Yeah, we can do it now.
I don't know what...
Do you want to explain the Dash 1 amendments, then?
It looks like they were introduced by financial institutions, and it's regarding writs when they're issued from more than one debtor, and it's just saying there's a separate fee that needs to be charged. I don't believe there's any opposition to them, to these amendments.
Okay. Well, okay. What we'll do, we'll proceed with the public hearing on House Bill 2275, and if necessary to come back with Dash 1 amendments, we'll talk to our witnesses and do that at the conclusion of the proceedings this afternoon. So if the person is available on 2275, will come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, can we all come up at the same time?
Sure. And you may go in any order you wish.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, for the record, Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And with me is Marsha Olemiller, our legal policy advisor, and Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. And I think, Wendy, did you want to start off with a little summary?
Sure. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, HB 2275, the cleanup bill to put put the age class status back into the civil rights statute for public accommodation purposes. ORS 659A.403 already lists race, religion, sex, marital status, color, and national origin. Age was inadvertently left out on the reorg bill, and this would put it back in. You should have before you a copy of the explanatory report on what happened with the statutes and the process. But this is not intended to change the law in the state of Oregon. It is a cleanup bill.
As I remember this from last session, this was in the 01 session, was a rewrite of the civil rights laws, and in the process we dropped out the age discrimination and public accommodation section, from what I understand. So this would represent no basic change in the law from what we intended in 01. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In order to have the rewrite be substantively neutral, which was the intent at that time, we inadvertently did not have the age and public accommodations included in that rewrite. So this would restore it to what it was prior to the rewrite.
Any questions of Ms. Talbot? Are the rest of you intending to testify, or would you like to take questions if we have them?
Chair Ackerman, I have really nothing to add to that. I participated in the Law Commission work group that worked on the rewrite, and what's been explained here already is pretty much my take on it as well, that it was an inadvertent omission of one of the categories.
Okay. Any further testimony from the panel?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that has occurred to all of us just as a result actually of a legislative staff question in the fiscal office was the issue of the possibility that someone may have lost their right due to the fact that this was not in the law in over the last 2 years. And if, with the committee's permission, we would love to be able to pursue with legislative counsel some sort of an amendment that would recognize that loss of the right and give them the same right they would have had with the same statute of limitations. And this would apply as well as to House Bill 2276, because there was a gap there where someone didn't have a right that they previously had before the rewrite, that we would like to give them that same legal recourse. And we would be glad to work with legislative counsel to get that drafted in a way that it didn't give them any additional right or any additional time, but it would just maintain what they would have had. And in terms of numbers, I know legislative counsel or legislative fiscal had asked us, only 1% of our complaints are public accommodations, so the likelihood that there are any significant ones for age under public accommodations is probably small, but nonetheless, there might have been one. We have more under injured workers, which is the next bill.
Right. Representative Brzozowski?
Thank you. I just want to get clarification. What you're saying is this additional, let's say, dash one amendment that would be coming would allow for individuals who would have been covered if this provision was in there, was actually in there, but you're not going to extend the statute of limitations for them to file. It just says that if you were harmed during that two-year period and the statute has not run, you could still move to seek some type of relief.
Actually, I think that there's a policy issue there, is whether or not for those where the statute had run, whether you would also give them a window of opportunity to have a right of action as well. And I think those would be the things we would like to discuss with legislative counsel and bring you back potentially two options there, one for some whose the statute might have run, extend that, and others who, you know, we don't want to give anybody larger rights than they would have otherwise had, but we also want to give them sufficient time to file if their statute may have run during that two-year period of time. So you could do one or a third, the broader one or the narrower one.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I can have one follow-up. Regarding the statute of limitation, I'm not familiar with this area of law. Do you know what the normal statute of limitation would be? Would it be 3 years or just 2 years? 1 year.
For filing with the Bureau, it would be 1 year, and I believe it's also 1 year to get into court, but I'd have to verify that.
Okay. Thank you.
I just walked in, so and I apologize. I've been testifying on some bills in the Rules Committee. Winnie, do you want to bring me up to date?
Sure. Gladly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've provided a quick summary of HB 2275, a summary of the addition of age back into the list of status for public accommodation claims, answered a couple questions, and we're ready to proceed.
Are there further questions about House Bill 2275? Now, there was a discussion about the need for an amendment. Is that right, Representative Jensen?
Just one kind of quick question. Was the inadvertent omission a consequence of a senior moment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, having not been involved, I would just say it was inadvertent in a large rewrite, and leave it at that if that's okay.
Okay.
It may have been a junior moment.
So the issue is simply that to the extent it was left out in the 2001 rewrite, that you need an amendment that would go back and pick up the availability of the remedy for the individuals since the 2001 bill went into effect. Is that right?
Chair Williams, that is correct.
Okay. And that is amendment. That's an amendment we don't have in front of us right now.
Correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Barker.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question about that. If the law didn't include that, how then could we go back on somebody and say, well, we forgot it, and so we should have, so therefore we're going to find you at fault, when the law didn't provide for that during that two-year period?
Mr. Chair, I suppose that's a policy issue, Representative Barker, that you would have to address, although that because it was the law prior to that time and it was just an inadvertent admission, I think there is an equitable reason you might do that. This apparently happened once before, and Marshall Miller might address that, in a disability statute that was rewritten, and the legislature did go back and recapture that. So do you want to...
Representative Barker, Chair Williams, that's true. A few years back when the disability statute underwent a major rewrite so that it was more in conformance with the federal Americans with Disabilities Act, a private right was inadvertently lost, and Ledge Council worked long and hard to restore it, and the language was quite complicated, but they did do the job, and they did stay within the parameters of the law as far as the rights of plaintiffs and defendants.
Representative Ackerman.
I think Representative Barker raised a question as to can we do this retroactively, and I believe since it's a procedural matter to give these people the rights that were lost, that we can act retroactively, restore the rights, and I think that's what the object would be.
Are there further questions? Well, to the extent we don't have the amendment, we'll need to request an amendment from Legislative Council for a draft and then repost the bill later for a work session. Thank you all. Have we heard from Danielle McNeil, the Oregon Student Association, on this bill? Okay, she's going to come up and testify next. Thank all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. For the record, I am Danielle McNeil, the student body president at Southern Oregon University, and I sit on the board of directors for the Oregon Student Association. The Oregon Student Association supports House Bill 2275. We believe that it is a critical addition to the statutes regarding discrimination in public accommodations. Now, prior to this committee meeting, we were unaware that it was in existence and simply an accidental omission. But while we're here, if it's okay with you all, I would like to speak to the merits of including age within the protected classes. As a student and a student leader at Southern Oregon, I've dealt with age discrimination in housing, both representing students and as a student myself. Last year, I decided to run for student body president, hoping that I could work on the critical issues that deny access to higher education for students. I found that there were many statewide issues concerning affordability and admissions that were vital that I work on, and I also found that there were many campus and community issues that denied access to students. In Ashland, housing is a major obstacle for students trying to obtain an education. Ashland has some of the highest rates of rent in the state, but additionally, there's a problem with age discrimination in public accommodations in Ashland. As I created my platform issues that I ran on to become student body president, I reached out to the students to find out what was important to them. I heard countless stories of students being denied housing purely based on their age and also because of their status as students. I made rental discrimination a major component of my campaign, and since taking office have made it a top priority of my administration. However, when I talk about discrimination against students, I'm not speaking about an isolated incident. In Ashland, discrimination against young people is a serious problem. Not only have students expressed their concern, but I myself was a victim of discrimination because of my age this fall. As I started looking for a place to rent, I went to the Daily Tidings classifieds, hoping to find the perfect place that would be waiting. Out of about 45 ads, there were multiple ads that clearly stated, "No students need apply," or my personal favorite, "No smoking, no pets, no students." I started to call the places that seemed open to students, and the first landlord I talked to was charming. I asked her some questions, she gave me great answers, and we quickly set up a time to meet at 11 the next morning. I told her that I look forward to seeing her place and that I'd see her the next morning, and just as we were about to hang up, she quickly asked me, "Wait, are you a college student?" To which I replied, "Well, yes, I am." Then she explained that she was sorry but could not show me the house. I asked her why, and she simply replied, "It's too much of a risk." It eventually took me 2 months to find a place to live, one that was affordable, clean, and would accept someone my age. As I stated earlier, I have made housing discrimination a major component of my administration at SOU. We've constructed a survey and sampled approximately 400 students asking various questions concerning public accommodations in Ashland. Among the many different things the survey detected, the most interesting seemed to be that students who had the least trouble renting in Ashland were non-traditional students, age 25 and over. The discrimination that students all over Ashland are facing is not simply because we are students, but because we are young and some associate youth with irresponsibility. As student body president, I have managed my time and my money very closely. I have to fulfill my job duties as student body president, make sure that I keep up in my classes, and hold down an additional job that pays my rent. And I am told that I am not responsible enough to rent an apartment. I am not that different than many students at SOU and across the state. Young people today hold down jobs, attend college, start businesses, pay their bills, and work hard to start their lives. And it is simply unfair that we are discriminated against solely based on our age. Young people have much to contribute and deserve an equal opportunity to do so. It is only fair to consider every case on an individual basis and avoid stereotypes and false assumptions. I hope that in the same way and for the same reasons we chose as a state not to allow discrimination against people based on race and gender, we would also protect the young citizens of Oregon from discrimination based on their age. Thank you for considering this legislation today, and on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, I urge you to pass the amendment to House Bill 2275. It may seem like a simple addition to the public accommodations law, but it's a very important step for young people across the state. Thank you again, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Danielle. Are there any questions from Ms. McNeil? Representative Crummell.
Mr. Chair, maybe this question is best answered by you or maybe one of the other people that testified, and that is an apartment considered a public accommodation?
Oh,
or a rental house, or that is.
Do I have somebody from Boley who wants to come forward and address that question? Marcia, you could just identify yourself again for the record.
Yes, Marcia Ole Miller, Legal Policy Advisor, Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. Actually, I'm looking right at the public accommodation law, which is ORS 30.675, and it says place of a public accommodation defined. A place of public accommodation means any place or service offering to the public accommodations, advantages, facilities, or privileges, whether in the nature of goods, services, lodgings, amusements, or otherwise. Now, there is a separate housing discrimination statute, but I have never seen anything that would indicate that housing is necessarily excluded from this because it's included in a specific statute otherwise.
Right.
So that's the response at the moment.
Does that answer your question, Representative Crummell?
Mr. Chair? Oh.
Yes, Representative
Shiloh. I do know that there are provisions in the somewhere that that do create a permissible category of, I think, adult housing that is exempt from this, that would be exempt from the age discrimination. In fact, I don't know, under federal law, I think age discrimination may be prohibited already.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I know in Oregon there is housing permitted for persons 50 or 55 and over.
Yeah, it depends on which category you want to come in. You can create a couple of categories of adult housing.
Right. I have a city in my legislative district that is almost entirely defined that way, the city of King City, that for some period of time, I don't think it's as true now as it used to be. You had to be over a certain age in order to buy a home there. So there are some of those limitations. Any further questions of the committee?
I do have one more,
yes,
Mr. Chair, if I may, and this may seem rather trivial, but I'm just curious, because obviously the person that you were applying to get housing from had equated the age of 18 with being a student. What if you would have told her, no, you weren't a student?
That's
would she have been open? I guess the question becomes: and would she have been open to renting the apartment or the house to you, or would she have said, "Well, no, I'm sorry, but based on the fact that you're 18 or 20 or whatever age you are"?
Likely, that might have been the case had I lied to her and said that. I've known students actually around Ashland that have actually been forced; they couldn't find a place to live. So when landlords asked them if they were a student, they simply lied and said they weren't, and then received a house and lived there and live under the whole idea that they're not students. And like I said, when we put out the survey, students who were over the age of 25, had I said that I was older, maybe it wouldn't have bothered her so much. I don't know. I didn't ask her. She didn't really want to talk to me after I told her I was a college student.
Representative Crummell, I think what happens then is when the landlord comes by to visit, they hide the textbooks under the bed and put out beer bottles in a Nintendo game, send a different signal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oops, I apologize for not addressing you before I answered the question.
No apology necessary. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much, Danielle.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2275? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2275, and we'll ask Legislative Counsel's Office to work with Council in preparing an amendment. Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2276. Council?
This one's actually mine.
Sure. Oh, all right, Phil.
Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2276 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon Law Commission. It permits compensatory and punitive damages in civil actions for violation of certain injured workers' rights. During the 2001 regular session, ORS Section 659A.043 and .046 were added, and compensatory and punitive damages, which should have been available under the intent of the statutory law, were unintentionally omitted. This measure would restore the original intent of the law by making such damages available once again.
So it looks very similar. Let's have Wendy Johnson come forward for the Law Commission, and again, Annette Talbert and Marcia, if you both come. Wendy, do you want to give any introduction?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, this is a cleanup bill from the 2001 reorganization bill. It would restore the availability of compensatory and punitive damages for two types of claims. ORS 659A.043 is the provision regarding reinstatement of injured workers back to their jobs after recovery. If you violate that that statute, then you would fall under this compensatory list. The other 659A.046 is similar. It's for those workers who are disabled and can't go back to their exact job, but perhaps a different job. Before the reorg, these damages were available. This bill would restore those. I would add that there was some possible opposition to this bill from NFIB. That opposition is no longer there, and to this point, I'm not aware of any opposition.
Thank you, Wendy. And I did talk to JL, and they did have some concerns, and I think when they understood that it was simply a restoration of prior rights, I think they decided not to oppose the bill. Great. Why don't we go ahead with Annette and Marcia?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'm not sure we have any additional thing to add. You have our written testimony from the commissioner, and Marcia or I would be available to answer any questions, but I think Wendy has already summarized that, and we would respectfully ask if a similar kind of amendment could be made to address those who lost this right over the last years with the work of Legislative Council and making sure that we address Representative Barker's procedural question about being able to go back and capture those folks. That would be great if we had that opportunity.
Okay. Are there any questions to any of the panel on House Bill 2276? Okay. Thank you. Hearing none.
I do have one.
Yes, Representative Shadow.
Okay, I'm sorry, but about that amendment, I guess, are there cases that you've had to dismiss or claims that you've had to not move forward on in the last couple of years as a result of the what this bill seeks to restore? I mean, do you know of cases that have been filed where you've had to say, sorry, we don't do that anymore?
Well, Representative Shetterly, unfortunately, the Bureau wouldn't know about those because they would have tried to go to court.
Okay.
And we don't have a way of tracking that.
The
BOLI would have still been able to take complaints under the injured worker statute.
Okay.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2276? Hearing none, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2276 and also request Council that we get an amendment from Legislative Council's office and reschedule the bill for work session. Next up is a public hearing on House Bill 2284.
I'll open that hearing and ask Mr. Carnegie, and who else do you want, David? I've got Professor Holland here listed.
And Professor Holland is attending to parking needs at the moment. And I think the committee's time would best be served if we were to defer this a moment until his arrival and take up another matter, Mr. Chair.
All right. We can do that. So we'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 2284 and return us colleagues to a work session. Let me get my bill stack organized here. House Bill 2274, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2274. Colleagues, I missed the testimony on this bill, although I will tell you it's a subject to which I have a substantial amount of familiarity, having spent the last 4 years of my life on the Law Commission working in the area of garnishments and judgments. That being said, was there much discussion with respect to the bill during the presentation? Right, I recognize there are amendments. Right. And the dash ones were testified to?
Mr. Chairman, the dash ones were not testified to. I have spoken with Tim Martinez, the Bankers Association. It's my understanding that that was an amendment that was supposed to be in the bill, was inadvertently left out.
Okay.
Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Well, then let me move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2274.
Representative Shetterly moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2274. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Hey, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to say that when I was out in the hall after this hearing, I did speak with Randy Jordan and Dave Hendricks, who also testified on this, and that was pretty much what they expressed to, that this was a consensus amendment.
And it's my recollection as well from the work group, and it was just inadvertently left out of the bill in the drafting stage. Randy, do you want to come forward and speak to the amendment?
It wasn't really left out here.
You can call me Your Honor. That's all right.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, excuse me. It wasn't left out, but it was put in Section 5. On examination, it looks like it would not have the effect that was intended by the committee, so we have moved it, the deletion there of the bold-faced material on line 2 is the same sentence that's being added to Section 16A, and we're just moving it to a different section of fee garnishment statutes to make clear that a $10 search fee applies to all garnishments and notices of garnishment. As written, it was not clear that it covered notices of garnishment. So this is a clarification just to make clear that it applies to all.
Right, but there was no disagreement.
No disagreement.
But the separate search fee would be, the $10 fee would be
that's correct.
Provided to the financial.
This just covers the intent that
right.
The committee had to draft.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification, Randy. Are there any questions? Okay, the motion is that we adopt the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries, and the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I'm sorry. Move House Bill 2274 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2274 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, hearing none, why don't we go ahead, Nancy, and call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Carmel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Pazansky.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2274 passes. As amended, and we'll move to the floor. Carrier volunteers?
I'll take that one.
You want to take
it? So it's your work group.
Well, it is, but I have a bigger judgments bill that's coming.
Okay.
That is going to make this look like a cheap dime novel. So I'm going to let you
All right, then I'll be glad
take
to.
It. Representative Shetterly or Carrie, the bill to the floor. With that, then, we're going to return to the public hearing on House Bill 2284 and ask Mr. Professor Holland to come forward.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Maury Holland, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Oregon. And I'm privileged to testify on behalf of the commission, the Oregon Law Commission, this afternoon in support of HB 2284. Please keep in mind that this proposed legislation has gone through some fairly fine netting up to reach this point. Being the work product of a very good work group consisting of Professor Don Vetri, a prominent plaintiff's lawyer, Don Corson, a fine defense lawyer, Joel DeVore, an experienced, respected trial judge, Judge Don Dickey, and Dave Hendricks, who extremely helpful. And then the full commission, including two legislators, Representative Shetterly and Senator Brown. So we think we have a good piece of legislation here. I would just, I've forgotten something. In accordance with, I guess, your rules, I have a written summary of my testimony. The last two pages of that handout provide you a presentation of the present ORS 12220 and what 12220 would look like if the amendment is passed. 12220 is what is known as a savings statute. At last count, about 40 other states, in addition to Oregon, have saving statutes, and Oregon itself has had one since statehood, in fact, substantially as provided now by the existing 12220. I think it only was amended once to incorporate the except as provided in ORS, whatever it was, in the Uniform Commercial Code. The problem with it is that it has the existing saving statute. Let me just say, in general, the purpose of a savings statute is to provide that if a claimant has the claim dismissed on a purely procedural basis, whereby the court never reaches the merits of the claim, that provided the action is refiled within a relatively prompt period, we provide for 180 days, following the initial dismissal, the same action can be refiled by the same claimant against the same defendant or defendants, without being automatically barred by res judicata. The theory of saving statutes is that, in accordance with modern procedure generally, every jurisdiction wants to avoid, as much as possible, having cases decided on purely procedural grounds, and sometimes depriving litigants of their day in court and the opportunity to get perhaps a good judgment to compensate them for their claim of injuries. The two defects in the current and present statute is, first of all, it doesn't say a single word about the fact that the basis for the original dismissal must be procedural. So if you were to read any competent lawyer reading the current version, which is on page A-1i, would wonder what under the sun this was all about, because it basically says you can sue, somebody can sue, and if they lose, if there's a dismissal, they can sue again, provided they do it within 1 year. Well, of course, the obvious question that would come to anybody's mind, of course, anybody can sue again the next day or 100 years later or at any point, but they would be immediately subject to dismissal for res judicata. So the courts that have construed this, the Oregon appellate courts, have construed this five or six times, have read into it the only sensible limitation, and that is the initial dismissal must be on a non-merits ground. It's fine that the courts have done that, but I think you might agree with me that it's better if statutes say what they mean in plain language. I've made a pest of myself in many ways, but one of them is I've gone around for years asking trial lawyers and trial judges if they've ever seen 12-220 invoked. And most of them had no idea. They knew it was in the ORS, but they couldn't imagine. They'd never seen it used. So the amendment would correct that deficiency by stating clearly that the amended version would have application only when the original dismissal is without prejudice and on a ground not adjudicating the merits of the action. Well, this reminds me to say something I should have said at the outset, because this particular piece of proposed legislation, fortunately, has the support of the Oregon State Bar. I don't think the commission would have brought it to you without that, particularly the Practice and Procedure Committee. And it was the Practice and Procedure Committee that spotted a loophole in the original version that the work group put out, and the loophole has been filled with this language on line, beginning on line 3 in the middle of the line, or with prejudice on the ground that the plaintiff has failed properly to effect service of summons within the time allowed by 12020, and the statutory limitations period had expired. I can get into that if there are any questions about it. It's kind of a technical point, but we were very happy with the constructive spirit of collaboration shown by the bar, and particularly that committee, most particularly its chair, Jeff Johnson, and Mr. Stu Johnson, Mr. Stu Brown, who worked with us to persuade us that there was a loophole and how it should be fixed. So as far as I know, there is no opposition to this. The work group and the commission, as I think it always does, when it has a proposed product, it sends it out to, we'd have a skywriter, I suppose, there's nothing secret about this, but we send it to all the usual suspects, that is, any organization or group that might have any interest, the judges, plaintiff's lawyers, defense lawyers, the bar. And the only response we got was from the bar. This committee said, you have a loophole in it, and you better fix it, which we have done. The other deficiency is that although the amended version would not limit its application to procedural dismissals for insufficiency of service, but would apply to others such as lack of jurisdiction, as a practical matter, it would be most often utilized and useful in cases that are not that uncommon, where a plaintiff's lawyer files the action maybe a day or two before the two-year or whatever limitations period expires, gets a server to make what they hope and think will be sufficient service, and then months later find out when the defendant moves for dismissal for insufficiency of service that the defendant was no longer a resident at that home. So the circuit court then, of course, grants the motion to dismiss, by which time refiling would usually be futile because the statute of limitations will have run. I cite in my testimony, and it's in this report, just one case that's illustrative of a problem that I think is, it's hard to tell because all I can read are the appellate opinions, but judging by the number of appellate cases, it's something that does come up in connection with what's called office service and substitute service. The case was Baker, I shouldn't say Baker versus Carr, Baker versus Doe, Baker versus Foy, which was, I think, correctly decided by the Oregon Supreme Court. It couldn't have decided any other way. And this was a typical situation, automobile accident where the defendant gave his residence address at the scene of the accident to the plaintiff. The plaintiff's lawyer, relying on that, got a server and said, take these papers and deliver it to the defendant. at this residence. And he wasn't there, but his mother came to the door. And she was, of course, a resident of that place, and over 14, or over 18, I guess it is. And she accepted the papers. And only months later did the plaintiff's lawyer find out that the kid had moved out of the house and was no longer his residence. So the circuit court had no choice, really, and it was affirmed by the Oregon Supreme Court, dismissal for insufficiency of service, even though the defendant got actual notice. Now, I ask you, attorneys in this committee, imagine if you were representing the plaintiff who might have had serious injuries, and you made a phone call, Mrs. So-and-so. This is your lawyer. Well, we're out of court. What do you mean? I thought we were going to have a trial, or they might settle. No, we're out of court. Why? Well, it's something you wouldn't understand, insufficiency of service. Well, didn't they get notice? Oh, yes, they got notice, but it doesn't count because it was insufficient service. And so we're done for. I will appeal, but that's the only option. What kind of an impression would people like that take away about the civil justice system in this state? They wouldn't know whether to blame their lawyer or the server or the judge or the law or the legislature, but they probably would think it was a lousy system. Doesn't happen to too many people, but it happens occasionally. This amendment would correct that result. But it would do so without dispensing with the requirement that before any court can proceed with adjudication on the merits of a claim, there must be sufficient service, which is a term of art, having constitutional overtones. But that could well happen with the alias service in a second action, because very often these defendants, as in Baker and Foy, live in Oregon, and they can be properly served if the plaintiff's lawyer is alerted to the problem, whatever it is, a change of residence or a mistake of some kind. So there are other situations where it might apply. Supposing somebody has a claim under Oregon law against an out-of-state defendant, and the court has to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. Could happen. Well, the plaintiff might have an opportunity to go to wherever the defendant resides and refile the action, but typically the statute of limitations would have barred the action by that time, particularly if there's an appeal. With this correction, the other courts, say in New York or California, where the defendant can be found and where there would be jurisdiction, would see that provided the new action was commenced within 180 days of the original dismissal, that as far as Oregon law is concerned, then, the action is not barred by the statute of limitations. So it could do some good. The other thing that I think it might be helpful, I was struck years ago when I started reading the judicial advance sheets of how many cases come up on appeal, particularly the Court of Appeals, where the only issue is sufficiency of service. And sometimes the court would reverse the trial court's dismissal and then would go back a year or two later for trial and extra money and time and expense. What puzzled me is why plaintiff's lawyers, when they get a dismissal from a trial court, but the defendant is available, hanging around, why don't they just do alias service? Find out where this kid, for example, this defendant did live, or just find him on the street or a job or wherever he could be served. Why don't they do that rather than go up on appeal, take a chance of getting a reversal, then get another trial 18 months or 2 years later? Well, the answer, of course, is that under the existing saving statute, usually alias service and refiling the action would be futile, again, because limitations expired. So I think that it would be a good thing for this state, and I think the judges of the Court of Appeals would agree that it's not a particularly productive use of this precious time that the Court of Appeals has to be trying to decide when the paper is given to a sister of the defendant in the post office with a promise that they will deliver the paper to the defendant, and in fact they do, then it becomes a big case on appeal. Non-lawyers, I've thought about this occasionally since I teach this subject, non-lawyers must be astonished at what a big deal our judicial system in this country, it's not just in Oregon, make about what would seem to anybody not trained in law should be the simplest thing in the world, just notifying somebody of something. We all do it every day with all kinds of people, and usually it's successful. Well, we, as lawyers, know that there are reasons why sometimes this question of notification is not as simple as lay people might think. But still, it's something that the ordinary litigant can't really cope with and doesn't understand. And when there's a failure, whether it be of the lawyer or the server, or perhaps the system, this would, to a modest degree, rectify that failure, and I think, therefore, it would be a good piece of reform. And I notice that on this particular thing, it's not, there's no group that I'm aware of that is in an uproar or is desperately trying to persuade you not to enact it. And thank you very much, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you, Professor Hahn. Are there questions for the professor? For those non-lawyers on the committee, I want to let you know that that is just a slight taste of an entire semester of a civil procedure class.
I hope it was slight enough.
And to the extent any of you have ever thought, or if there's anyone listening who's ever thought about law school, I hope you remember this experience.
So, in other words, don't create the competition for...
I will tell you, Professor Hahn, that... we do appreciate the work you do, both with respect to the Council on Court Procedures and your involvement in these issues, because it really is important that we address this issue in a savings statute, and you're absolutely right about the impact, particularly of inappropriate service causing a result of someone's statute of limitations running. Are there particular questions that anyone has about that impact? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm concerned about the qualifier that the defendant have actual notice, not later than 60 days after the action was filed. In a situation, perhaps, where you had insufficient service but take a default judgment, more than 60 days goes by, and the defendant retains counsel and sets aside that judgment, then wins on the insufficiency of service, it seems to me the plaintiff can't refile because the defendant did not have actual notice within 60 days of the filing of the complaint. Would that scenario be correct?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, I believe it is correct. And the explanation that I would offer is that we felt it was important not to deprive defendants of the protection that they get from statutes of limitations. That is, people ought to know that they're not going to be sued for things that happened too long ago, which they may have forgotten about, or whatever. And the decision, therefore, was made that for this to be triggered, this relief to be triggered, it would be essential that one way or another, the defendant would have to have actual notice within the period now provided for by law, 60 days of filing. And I suppose almost always that would be because of insufficient service. We'll lead to the courts maybe bizarre situations where somebody learns over the telephone or by accident, but it will almost always be, just as in Baker, where the defendant showed up at his old home and the mother gave, here they are, and he read. But we didn't think it would be a good idea to delete that requirement, because then statutes of limitations could be eviscerated.
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, and I think this does tie in with the statute of limitations. I don't have the statute in front of me, but it seems to me that when you file a suit up, that is, you file your complaint with the court up to the date of the statute of limitations, you then have 60 days to make good service, and if you do, then you're considered to have commenced your suit within the period of the statute of limitations. So I think this 60 days basically just picks that up. Since this would be cases that are crossing the bar of the statute of limitations, I think you have to have complied with that first rule of getting it in time in the first place, at least within the statute.
That's correct.
Further questions?
Not that I ever file that close to the statute.
Only when they come in on the evening of the day, right?
That's right.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Professor Hahn. We appreciate your testimony.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on House Bill 2284? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2284. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2284.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2284 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2284 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just have a question.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
Just out of curiosity, why is it that when sufficient notice must be given within 60 days, but on a refiling you're given 180 days?
You have to refile within 180 days. What is a qualification to earning that extra time? You have to show that the defendant had actual notice of the original filing.
Right.
Within 60 days of that filing.
Okay.
No, what it says is that you have to refile your suit within 180 days. You can't wait longer than 180 days to refile. Is that right, Professor Holland?
I think you're correct, and maybe you should have mentioned this. This 180 days is in substitution of a 1 year
right.
Under the old one.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And we thought with telephones and stuff that 180 days was fairer to defendants to keep them waiting.
Right. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Representative
Crummell?
Any other questions or discussion on the motion of Representative Shetterly? Hearing none, then, why don't we go ahead and call the roll, Nancy?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Baker?
Aye.
Jansen?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Zanski?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2284 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I would like to assign this bill to Representative Ackerman, if you'd be willing.
Oh, happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, that takes us to the last item on our agenda today, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2426. You will recall that House Bill 2426 was before us last week, and the issue again was access to public meeting access on advisory committees. Technical or advisory committees or advisory task forces with the authority to make decisions for, conduct policy research for, or make recommendations to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. Essentially a companion bill to a similar bill we passed last session, which was House Bill 2945. Now is the time, even though this is a work session, to the extent that there was anybody who wanted to come forward and testify or make comments with respect to this bill. We, as you'll recall, delayed this bill to give the office an opportunity to come forward. I am aware that they are aware of the bill, and they don't appear to be here today to speak in opposition to the bill. So I'm assuming that silence, at least at this point, means assent. Or if they had a problem with it, they would come and tell us about it. Yeah, I'll mention it. Okay, we will then. The chair would move House Bill 2426 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right. Yes, Representative Anderson.
I think one of the elements, thank you, Mr. Chair, is that it's difficult many times, having come here prior years, to testify from Southern Oregon, or if you're coming from out of state, that it's very frustrating to not be included in the actual meetings and oftentimes postponed. And I think the same thing is happening here, where postponements get or meetings get postponed, and there's no notice because it's all kind of done in secrecy, or there has been some secrecy. So I think it's a very good bill to open up and get some sun shining in on the the whole process. Seems to me like it's a very good move.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, hearing none, let's call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Trumbull?
Aye.
Gerson?
Aye.
Levansky?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair
Lewis? Aye. House Bill 2426 moves to the floor for the due pass recommendation, and Representative Anderson will carry the bill. And that concludes our agenda for the day, colleagues. Thank you very much.